Okay, good evening. Tonight is a special night. It's Yud Tet Kislev, the 19th of Kislev. And the 19th of Kislev is a special day in the Hasidic calendar in general. The Hasidic calendar is very interesting because it has many, many special days. In fact, there is even a little publication that is published daily which has a list of the Hasidic memorial dates for that day and announcements about which Brit and which Chatunah and which this and which Mesibah are taking place in the Hasidic community. One day someone will write a Mechka on the I think it's I can't remember the name of it, but it's published in the Stamford Hill community, the Haredi community, the Hasidic community. So prominent topic is like right at the top of the list of all the Hasidic yard sites. Now Yud Tet Kislev is the yahrzeit of the second leader of Hasidism, Rabbi Dov Ber, the Magid of Mezerich. But that is not what makes it so special for Chabad. The point is that in 1798, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi, the founder of Chabad, was arrested by the government. And he was arrested because there was an accusation against him which had been framed by the accusation had been laid by the opponents of Hasidism, the Mitnagadim. And they made this accusation because they thought Hasidism was something very dangerous. They saw it as a form of Shabbateanism or Frankism, Frankism existed in the middle of the 18th century in Poland. And they were very frightened that Hasidism would lead to people not keeping mitzvot. So they decided to try to stamp out this new movement, and they got the idea that since Rabbi Shneur Zalman was in charge of sending large sums of money to the Holy Land to support the Hasidic community, which was in Tiberias and Tzfat and other towns. So since he was doing that, they could prove that he was sending money to the Ottoman Empire, and that meant that they could say that he's sending money to the Turks, and that would be a capital crime in Russia, since the political relationship between Russia and Turkey was very bad. So he would be a traitor and he would be put to death. So,
goodness me.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, it is a very shocking thing. And he was arrested. And quite a number of stories about the period of this arrest. One of them being that the Tsar heard that there was a remarkable Jewish leader who was in prison, and he came to visit him in plain clothes, not dressed like the Tsar. He just came looking like an ordinary soldier. And he came into the cell of Rabbi Shneur Zalman, and Rabbi Shneur Zalman immediately stood up and mumbled something. And the Tsar said, "What did you say?" So Rabbi Shneur Zalman said, "I said the blessing that has to be said when you see a king. There is a Hebrew blessing that must be said when you see a king. When I was a child, it was the correlation, as I remember, we all gathered, the Queen was going to drive past where we, in North London, where I live, and we said this blessing. So there's discussion about whether the blessing is as powerful today as it was then. The point about the blessing is to have, if the king has power over life and death, so the Tsar, certainly, he could have people executed or not. So at that time, there was still hanging in England, and the Queen had the power of pardon. So she clearly did count for this blessing. So, you know, question about whether now or not. But anyway, so Rabbi Shneur Zalman stood up and he said, I said the blessing which is said when one sees a king. So the Tsar said, how do you know I was a king? So Rabbi Shneur Zalman said, the Tsar of Russia, that means the angel in charge of Russia, came in with you. So it was clear that you were a king. Anyway, together with a lot of political activity by the Chabad Hasidim on behalf of getting their rabbi out of this situation, you know, Chabad Hasidim do not wear a silver decoration on their talit. My grandfather, Alav HaShalom, he had a beautiful talit with a wide little silver, like little boxes all sewn together. And that's a very general custom in Poland and Russia to wear these silver decorations on the talit. But in Chabad Lubavitch, no one wears them. Because in the time of Rabbi Shneur Zalman, everyone took off the silver decoration of the talit and donated it for the fund for dealing with the situation of getting Rabbi Shneur Zalman free from prison. So there were all kinds of hishtadlut efforts made, and finally on the 19th of Kislev 1798 he was released from prison. Now, when you have a problem in a family or in a community, and then the problem is solved with the help of God, so one celebrates. But what makes this such a special celebration? I mean, surely there have been many ups and downs, if you like, for the Chabad community, as all Jewish community. It is because the whole project of teaching Hasidic thought was under threat. Not just in the practical term that Rabbi Shneur Zalman, who was a major or the major leader of Hasidism at that particular moment, was under threat physically, and conceivably, God forbid, the government could have banned Hasidism, but it might well have survived even if the government did ban Hasidism. Its governments didn't have very great power over the flourishing of the Jewish community in all kinds of different ways. But it was from Rabbi Shneur Zalman's point of view. He understood his arrest as a heavenly argument over whether it was right for him to be teaching Hasidic ideas to the wider public. When you have a little Kabbalistic circle like Rabbi Isaac Luria had, a Kabbalistic circle in Tzvat, so he had a small number of followers, I think it was 26 people, and these were absolutely deeply spiritual people, the husband, the wife, each of the people involved with Rabbi Isaac Luria was a very, very spiritual person. And in many ways they were led by Rabbi Chaim Vital, who took control of this group in a sense after Rabbi Isaac Luria passed away, and made sure that they would agree that he would be the only one communicating the teachings of Rabbi Isaac Luria. But this, it's a little circle of very spiritual people. The Hasidic movement, begun by Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov in the middle of the 18th century, had the outspoken goal to communicate these teachings in a much broader way. As in a visionary experience, the Baal Shem Tov was told by Mashiach, he asked Mashiach, "Eimatai ka'ati ma?" When are you coming? And Mashiach answered him, "L'chashiyafutzu ma'inotecha chutza," when your teachings burst out to the outer world, to the outside. Outside the little circle, there are ever widening circles. What does it mean, outside? So this was the program that the goal that Rabbi Shneur Zalman had, and his publication of Tanya in 1796 was focused on this goal to communicate these spiritual teachings to a wide circle. Then when he was arrested in 1798, he saw this as a criticism, a divine argument. Maybe he is wrong. Now I must tell you that among his colleagues, among the Hasidim, there were people who were critical of this wide dissemination of Hasidic spirituality. One of them was a rabbi called Rabbi Avram of Kalisk. Rabbi Avram of Kalisk was a very enthusiastic figure who went in 1777, like many of the Hasidic leaders and followers, he went to the land of Israel with Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk or of Horodok, who was an older colleague of Rabbi Shneur Zalman. And they ran the Hasidic community in Tiberias. And when Rabbi Nachum Mendel of Vitebsk passed away in 1789, then Rabbi Avram was the leader of that community. And when he heard about the publication of Tanya, he wasn't happy about it. He didn't like the idea of Tanya being published. He thought it was breaking through borders. He didn't use that word, but he saw that this was making spiritual teachings too easily available. He wrote, "Too much oil can put out the light. Al yedei ribui hashemen yichabe ha'or." And he was arguing against this. And then when Rabbi Shneur Zalman was arrested, Rabbi Shneur Zalman himself said, "Maybe my friend is right. Maybe it's true that I shouldn't be disseminating, teaching these ideas so broadly." And then when he was released, he said, "Right, that means the heavenly court has decided in favor of teaching Hasidic thought." And from then on, his style changed so that his teachings became much more what we call the Chabad style of teaching, the Chabad intellectualist style of teaching, where there is a whole intellectual structure. This specifically Chabad style, his teachings before Peterburg, as it's called, because he was arrested and taken to St. Petersburg. So in Hasidic internal historiography, it's called Peterburg. So his teachings before were shorter and were luminous and were in a sense above seichel, above intellect, except Tanya is a very rational and highly organized work. But his other teachings, his weekly Torah teachings on Shabbat. Then when he was released from prison in 1798 on Yutet Kislev, he felt this was the heavenly go-ahead to teach teachings in a broad way, and it was as if a barrier had been broken through. Now, the barrier, in fact, he was arrested again 2 years later, and then he was released from that. And he was, in fact, made an honored citizen by the Tsar. So much so that when Napoleon attacked Russia, Rabbi Shneur Zalman joined the Tsar's personal retinue. And Rabbi Shneur Zalman and his family traveled together with the Tsar and his court. And Rabbi Shneur Zalman came a lot in contact with the Tsar. And there's an interesting letter written by his son about Rabbi Shneur Zalman's impression of the Tsar. It's during that journey. It's in 1812. So that's the... so that is the beginning of Yutet Kislev, and in 1901, the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote a letter saying that he considers the 19th of Kislev as the Rosh Hashanah of Hasidism. It is the real new year of Hasidism. Because that was the focal point, that moment of heavenly agreement that Rabbi Shneur Zalman should teach in this broad way, that was the real start of the full sense of what the Hasidic movement is about in terms of taking these very exalted Kabbalistic concepts, reaching their essence, which is the point at which they relate to every person, and communicating them, which is the ideal of this Chabad chain of Hasidic teachings that we're looking at. Now, there are a number of, every year, for many, many years, the late Lubavitcher Rebbe would have a Hasidic gathering on the night of Yud-Tet Kislev, and very often the Dibur HaMatchil, the opening sentence of the discourse, was Pada B'Shalom Nafshi, God has redeemed in peace my soul, because Rabbi Shneur Zalman wrote a letter saying, as I was saying to Tehillim, and I came to this verse, Pada B'Shalom Nafshi, they informed me that I was being released. So he remembers it as being when he said those words. And he wrote this to Rabbi Baruch of Medzibos, who was the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov. And he said something like, on your behalf, I have been through this experience of being put in prison and of being released. And you should know that this is something relevant for everyone, the fact that I have been released in this way. And so he was writing to Rabbi Baruch of Medzibos as the son, the grandson of the founder of Hasidism. And he was telling him that this is a new stage for the Hasidic movement as a whole, which indeed it was. So that is the... Rosh Hashanah of Hasidism, and there are many discourses beginning Pada B'Shalom Nafshi, and on the website for the two previous years we learnt a discourse which begins Pada B'Shalom Nafshi, but this year we are learning a different discourse which was said in 1978, 5739, on Yutet Kislev, and it begins in a different way, relating to a verse in the book of Shoftim. Now it's a verse in Shirat Dvorah. Dvorah sang a song after her successful dealing with the Syrian war and the capture or the killing of Sisera, and who was killed by Yael, if you remember, a woman. So this is like a women very active at this point in Tanakh, and Devorah was the shofet. She was the judge of the Jewish people, and she would sit under a tree, under a date palm, and so that there wouldn't be yichud if men came to her to be have their case analyzed. And after this successful war, she sang a song which we have here, V'tashar Dvorah uVarak ben Abinoam. Barak, he was the sort of active general, but Dvorah was the power behind him. He wouldn't have been anything without her. So she sang this song, and on verse 11, Mikol mechatzitzim bein meshabim, sham yitanu tzidkot Hashem, tzidkot pirzono b'Yisrael, az yardu l'sha'arim am Hashem. Okay, like many of the verses in this Shira, it's extremely difficult to understand what it means. Or you could put it that the different commentators present different ways of understanding it. But basically, the simplest line of understanding it, Kol mechatzatzim bein hamashabim, is the sound of the archers among the people drawing water. So the archers, among the people drawing water, the archers with their bows and arrows, and they are sort of walking around and saying different things. They make a lot of noise. They're like, war heroes. And they are striding around the water place, like in the bar, and they are talking about, I shot this one, I shot that one. Now, more powerful than that, see, that's the force of the letter mem. More than that, sham yitanu tzidkot Hashem. People will talk about the righteousness of God. They'll talk about the miracles of God more than the war stories by the heroes, by the archers, who have been at the forefront of the battle. There will be people telling over tzidkot Hashem, the righteous acts of God. And the word yitanu is understood like yishanu. They will repeat them. They'll say over the words, the righteous acts of God. Tzidkot pirzono beYisrael. The righteousness of his scattering through the Jewish people, all the different places, that this happened there, and this happened there, this miracle happened in this place, and there was another wondrous tzidka, the staka from Hashem in another place. Az yardu l'sha'arim am Hashem, then the people of God will go to the gates. In other words, there'll be a kind of spiritual takeover. Instead of just the physical might of the archers and the warriors being at the top, there will be the am Hashem, the people of God. They will be the ones at the gates. Okay, so it says something of this kind in the English translation here, but what I've just told you is based on a very simple peirush of Tanakh Metzudat David. I should have brought that in photocopy, but I didn't, sorry. But Metzudat David gives a very, very straightforward translation, basically, of Tanakh into simple Hebrew. And he wrote a companion commentary called Metzudat Zion, which gives the explanation of the difficult words. So there are quite a few other commentaries, but that's a simple way of understanding this verse.
Ali, before you take us into it, can I just ask you a question before we leave history behind about the historical context at the time? When the plotters and intriguers brought Rabbi Schneerzalman to such peril? Who were they? What was that caucus? Was this the Vilna Gaon and his associates? Was there?
Well, the point is, the Vilna Gaon was not an active person in society. He was completely withdrawn from all aspects of the community, to the extent that he did not actually have any communal position. He wasn't like a rabbi of Vilna. A rabbi of Vilna, or the rabbi of Vilna, was a very busy man dealing with the affairs of the community. The Vilna community at that time was rent by all kinds of disputes and quarrels. But the Vilna Gaon, one story about the Vilna Gaon was, the community did agree that they would pay him a stipend to support him, because they recognized him as a very great Talmudist, a very great man. And the man who was supposed to pay the stipend, unfortunately, pocketed half of it and only gave the other half to the Vilna Gaon. And the Vilna Gaon never mentioned it, and just lived as a recluse, studying Torah the whole time, teaching a small group of people, one of whom became a Hasid. I'm not sure if it wasn't the same Avraham of Kalis. Certainly one of his close disciples became a Hasid, which... And the real opponents of the Hasidim were the rabbinates who had been displaced. Hello, Akiva. The rabbinates who had been displaced by charismatic Hasidic teachers. Because in those days, the rabbinate was something that you farmed economically. You paid 5,000 rubles to a community, and they then made you their rabbi, and you got various economic benefits by being the rabbi. So, for example, before Purim, I think, and maybe Hanukkah, everyone would give a gift to the rabbi, and there were all kinds of other ways the rabbi would be earning money from the community. And of course, in order to be a rabbi, he had to be a scholar, had to be able to decide halachic questions. But it was a very peculiar situation, very much to the detriment of the Jewish community at the time. And the key figure in the fight against Rabbi Schneerzalman, particularly in the second arrest, but probably also in the first, was Avigdor of Pinsk. Now, Avigdor of Pinsk had been the rabbi in Berdichev, and he was very angry when the community dismissed him as a rabbi and took instead the great Hasidic leader, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, who is famous for his speaking of good about every single Jew, and he was a much more loved figure without this whole economic thing. And the community wanted Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev and not this Avigdor. And Avigdor went and cooked up a whole thing together with the other rabbis who were also concerned about this spread of Hasidism and these charismatic figures. It was a kind of, it was the question of who has authority in the community. And since the Hasidic movement arose partly because they could see that the nature of Jewish authority in Eastern Europe was actually having a bad effect on Judaism, that there was an ivory tower scholarly class which couldn't relate to ordinary men. This wasn't the chidush of the Hasidim, seeing this as a social problem. There were many books and publications describing this problem in the middle of the 18th century, with many rabbis and other figures lamenting the problem. And as Joseph Weiss, Professor Joseph Weiss of in UCL, he was a professor in UCL, he pointed out, it was there were the official town rabbis, and then there was another rabbinic class who weren't the official town rabbis. And Hasidism began to a great extent among this other class, like alternative rabbis, if you like. They were rabbanim who were not tied into this rather peculiar system. There were some town rabbis who also became Hasidic leaders, like Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polonia was the first publicist of the Hasidic movement. He was the rabbi of Sharagrod. And his relationship with the Baal Shem Tov began as being highly critical of him. And then he became a Hasid. See, the Baal Shem Tov came along to Sharagrod, and the first thing that Rabbi Yaakov Yosef notices is there's no minyan in the morning. 7 o'clock in the morning, and there's only 5 people in shul. Where are they? He was a very short-tempered man. So he goes out, and he finds the Baal Shem Tov talking to a group of people. And they've been talking to the Baal Shem Tov, not coming to shul. Typical. So he got very annoyed. And somehow or other, I may be confusing two different stories, but he then saw the Baal Shem Tov after the prayers smoking a long clay pipe, and for a moment he maybe thought, how low. They say this man is a great tzaddik. Look at him, just smoking a clay pipe like a peasant. And suddenly, he began weeping uncontrollably. And he then realized that the only person who could help him is the Baal Shem Tov. And he went to the Baal Shem Tov and he spoke with him. And the Baal Shem Tov gave him a kind of tikkun, which turned him into an ardent publicist of the Hasidic movement. And our understanding of the social problem, as seen by the Hasidim, is described by Rabbi Yaakov Yosef in his books. And he wrote a book called Toldot Yaakov Yosef. And Theodore Dresner wrote an analysis of the book for his PhD, and that's called The Tzaddik. And it's an academic presentation of the social dynamic as seen by Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, that the people are divided in two. They're Anshei Hatzura, the men of form, that means the scholars, the Anshei HaChomer, the men of matter, who are the rest of the Jewish people, and they are divided apart. And in order to bring them together, you need a kind of figure from among the men of form who reaches down to the wider community and joins with them. How does he join with them? The first thing is he finds within himself a point which joins together with the ordinary person. He doesn't see, that pipe is like part of it. And he doesn't see himself as beyond them. He finds some way in which he is together with them. And in that way he lifts them up. So it's a fascinating idea, this, of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polonia. But the point is that this was causing a social ferment, and very negative and hostile elements. There were people who criticized the Hasidim and all kinds of stories, you know, not being a Hasid, or people being very upset their son-in-law became a Hasid, things of this kind. But another step was made by this going to the courts and trying to have Rabbi Shneur Zalman killed. That was a different level. And they did get the Vilna Gaon involved in it, whom most people see as just, he believed that the Hasidim were another kind of Shabbatean, and so that was it. Well, if they're Shabbatean, so you got to get rid of them. So he didn't actually know anything about them. Rabbi Shneur Zalman tried to see the Vilna Gaon. He came to Vilna to see the Vilna Gaon, and the Vilna Gaon climbed out of his own window to get away from Rabbi Shneur Zalman. And I've heard a person very sympathetic to the Vilna Gaon saying that he was simply frightened that if he met Rabbi Shneur Zalman, Rabbi Shneur Zalman would captivate him.
Would embrace him.
That would be the end. So perhaps with good reason he tried to get away. In fact, Rabbi Shneur Zalman said if he would have agreed to see me, he would have become my greatest disciple. So that's part of the history of
Thank you. I'm sorry for this.
No, that's all right. No, that's all part of it. But what it means is that Hasidism is breaking through borders in the community. It's this divide between the men of form and the men of matter, that divide, that barrier has to be broken through in some way. And it's also breaking through borders in Torah. The exoteric dimension of Torah, Nigle, the Talmud, the Shulchan Aruch, has to, in the Hasidic eyes, has to connect with the esoteric, Kabbalistic, spiritual dimension. So that's another border. You see, you could have a complete compartmentalization. For example, Rabbi Avraham ben David of Poskier, who lived in the 13th century and was a great critic of Maimonides. And he wrote Hasagot HaRaibad, which are printed in Mishneh Torah. He was a great Kabbalist as well. But hardly ever in his writings, in his halachic writings, do you see a tiny remez to his Kabbalistic knowledge. That was another dimension. And the Hasidim were trying to connect these different dimensions of the Jewish community and within Torah. So that is where we're going to come to our discourse, which is Rabbi Oshia in the Talmud commenting on this verse that we've just read, this rather complicated verse that we've just read. And it's a comment by Rabbi Oshia that will begin our discourse, and we will, in order for us to open the barrier between ordinary life, as it were, and the spirituality of the discourse, we will try to sing the melody of the Maimon, the Maimon Eagle. Oh, yo, 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 ya, 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 yo, ya, 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 yo, ya, mom. Oh, ya, 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 yo, ya. Ha ya ya yo ya ya yo, oh ya ya de lamba ya ya yo ya ya de lamba yamba yo, ha ya de lamba ma ya de lamba ho ya ya yamba ya de lamba. Ho ya yamba ya de lamba ya 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 yo ya ya yo. Omer Rabbi Oshia, this is in the Talmud, in Psachim, Pei Zayin Amud Bet. You've got the footnote there. Rabbi Oshia said, "My dichtiv, what does it mean when it says tzidkat pirzono beYisrael?" The righteousness of the scattering of Israel. Staka asa HaKadosh Baruch Hu BeYisrael. God did something very righteous, very charitable with the Jewish people. Shepizran levein haumot, that he scattered them among the nations of the world. Now, what does that mean? ומבא כבוד קדושת מורי בחמי אדמו"ר במאמרו דיבר המתחיל זה. Now, the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, says in his discourse, which begins on this with this line, which he said on Yutet Kislev in 1928, which was in the middle of the Sheva Brachot of the Rebbe, our Rebbe. He got married the 14th of Kislev, 1928, in Warsaw. And so this is still in the Sheva Brachot, and on the 19th of Kislev, this is the discourse that Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak said. Ve'al yedei sheYisrael mefuzarim b'chama midinot. Through the fact that the Jewish people are scattered in many different countries, hinei gam kashu b'medina achat. So then, even if in one country, dochakim v'lochatzim et b'nei Yisrael, they are oppressed. The Jewish people are oppressed. Ve'ein notnim lahem l'lmot Torah l'kayim mitzvot, and they're not permitted to study Torah and to keep mitzvot. Va'ad shebekama mitzvot hem anusim mamash, till in certain mitzvot they are completely forcibly prevented from doing them. She'ein lahem efsharut klal l'kayim otam, they're not able at all to keep these mitzvot. Afilu al yedei mesirat nefesh, even through self-sacrifice. See, there might be a mitzvah that they can keep with great danger, like Brit Milah, for example. The Rebbe, at this point, in 1978, he was thinking of the Jews in Russia, which he had a very close connection with, and he was sending shluchim, he was sending emissaries, secretly, into Russia, who would make contact with a little group of Lubavitch Hasidim and the people that they had influence on in Moscow and Petersburg and other places. Rabbi Shmuel Lu, my friend, he was one of the people who would go into Russia in a secret way, bringing secretly mezuzot and different things which he would... so you weren't allowed to bring anything, so everything he said was for his use. So even his tefillin, he came in with his tefillin. He davened shacharit on the last day he was there, and then he just left the tefillin in the synagogue, and he went to the airport without his tefillin, so that a Russian Jew would be able to use his tefillin. So and that was the kind of thing that had to be done, which also was dangerous. However, there were some mitzvot, let's say putting on tefillin, so maybe you could get hold of a pair of tefillin like that and you could put them on, but what happens if you couldn't get hold of a pair of tefillin? What can you do in order to get tefillin? What can you do, here it says in brackets, ludugma, for example, kashayesh gzeirat malchut shelo lahachnis lamdina dalet minim, when there's a law not to allow lulav etrog, and the other parts of the what's used on Sukkot, they wouldn't allow that into the country. There was no way of getting an etrog and a lulav into Russia. So gam al yedei mesirat nefesh ei efshar lekayem mitzvah. Even if you were a person who was ready to risk their life, but there was no way they could get a hold of it. So there you have one place where people cannot keep mitzvah. Hine al yedei sheYisrael hanimtzaim b'sham medinot. Through the fact that the Jewish people who are in different countries oskim b'Torah mitzvot are involved with Torah, they study Torah and they keep mitzvot freely, heim notnim koach v'oz, they give power gam le'elu, to those people aninsim b'makom sheyesham gzeirot, who are in the place where there are these decrees against Judaism, sheyuchlu l'lmot Torah l'kayim mitzvot, so that they will be able to learn Torah and keep mitzvah. So in other words, there is an interaction between the Jewish people, since the Jewish people are all one. Now that's one of the basic concepts of Yutet Kislev and of Hasidism, is the oneness of the Jewish people. Just today I was reading some academic records of the unfortunately there was some really rabid maskilim quite apart from the question of the mitnagdim, there were also maskilim who were determined to destroy the Hasidic movement and did whatever they could against them. In the end, the mitnagdim saw that a bigger danger, both for the Hasidim and the mitnagdim, were the maskilim, so they sort of joined forces with the Hasidim, and so at the end, by the end of the 19th century, basically the Hasidim and the mitnagdim made peace, more or less. So there were maskilim writing comments.
Who were the maskilim?
The maskilim today are the enlighteners. Right. These are people...
Today, who would they be?
Well, you know, in each era, whatever one has is sui generis, you know, has its own particular qualities. So one could say that the exact version of maskilim, you see, Mendelssohn was in Berlin. And there are different ways of looking at Mendelssohn, that he didn't conduct any kind of vicious campaign against Jews. He sometimes didn't agree with what the rabbis wanted. There was an argument about the date of, about burying people on the day they died. According to Jewish law, you're supposed to bury a person as soon as they die. And there was a German law which said you had to wait 3 days because maybe the person's not really dead. They didn't have the medical knowledge to ascertain precisely whether or not a person was dead. And so Mendelssohn was on the side of the government. But he didn't... he did things which had very far-reaching and problematic effect. He managed to persuade German Jewry to forsake the Yiddish language and adopt the German language. And he worked at this with a scheme, and then the scheme was successful. But in Eastern Europe, the maskilim of Eastern Europe were a very, very, they were real, they were people who would tell the government, this man is very bad and that man, and you should arrest this rabbi. And the maskilim of them were the ancestors of the Yevsektsiya in Russia, the Jewish section of the Communist Party, who had rabbis killed. Because they believed so fervently in communism that they believed that the way forward is to have these terrible rabbis killed, because they are stopping the march of progress and the world revolution.
So in Israel, would they today be the secular Jewry, who are intellectuals?
I wouldn't see anyone today in such a... You know, there are lots of conflicts among the Jews, but I don't see anyone as having the same kind of viciousness. Even my dear friends in the academic world.
So there aren't any more maskilim, then?
Well, the maskilim don't exhibit the vicious qualities that the Eastern European maskilim...
That some of the vicious qualities in Israel.
Well, I don't. I think there are two concepts in Israeli society which are problematic. One is to say chiloni, and the other is to say dati. No Jew is chiloni, however much he might claim to be. And being dati is not just a matter of a simple symbolic identification. So every Jew in Israel is a very, very deeply spiritual person, and it sometimes works in different ways, but it's they're all Jewish idealists of one form or another. Now, so therefore, this idea of the unity of the Jewish people is being expressed here in a very fascinating way. That through the fact that one part of the Jewish people is not able, the problem, that one part of the Jewish people is not able to keep Torah properly, but in another part of the Jewish people, in another country, they can compensate and give strength. They can add strength to the first group, so that eventually they will be able to keep Torah and Mitzvot themselves. I remember myself hearing the Rebbe say in a Hidvadut, in a Hasidic gathering, which was being phoned through to England, and I can remember where I was standing at the time when I heard this, where the Rebbe suddenly said, you should donate some of your Torah study to the Jews of Russia. So the Rebbe had encouraged strongly his Hasidim regularly to study Torah. but an important part of that is studying the whole of Mishneh Torah every year. So studying three chapters of Mishneh Torah each day means that in less than just under a year you cover the entire oral Torah as far as its halachic dimension as presented by the Rambam. And so he said, and there are other things people have to learn, Talmud, and have to learn Shulchan Aruch, and have to learn Chumash Udrashi, and Tanya, and Hasidic teaching, and so on. So the Rebbe said a person should donate some of their Torah study to the Jews of Russia. It's a kind of a spiritual transaction. So what it says here is not that this substitutes for the Jews of Russia who aren't able to study Torah, but that it gives them power so that they will be able to study Torah and they will be able to keep mitzvah. So who knows if that wasn't part of the fascinating process which led to the fact that now in Russia there are yeshivot, there are this Jewish schools and all kinds of institutions. In a most remarkable way. I remember I was in a conference in Moscow of the European Union of Jewish Studies, European Association of Jewish Studies. So a few years ago there was a conference in Moscow. So I had given a paper, and my colleague of mine had given a paper, and there was a Ukrainian professor from Kiev who had been the chairman of that session. So then I thought that the three of us, we will go and visit the Lubavitch Center in Moscow, the Marina Rocha Synagogue complex. So we came along there, and it's a huge building, and on every floor there's something else happening. There's a synagogue, a restaurant, study house, library, this, that, the other. And the Ukrainian professor suddenly says, when I was 12 years old, he was also a professor of Hasidic history. He said, when I was 12 years old, I came here, and it was a little smaller place, and they taught me Hebrew and things about Judaism, and eventually he became a professor in the University of Kiev. And he said it was amazing to come back and see this this tremendous what it had become, thank God. So this is an aspect of this spiritual transaction of learning Torah in such a way that it helps other people who are not able to learn Torah because of the Zerot HaMalchut, because of the decrees of the government. And he goes on to explain this process. So, min hakal el hakaved, from the easy to the more difficult. V'tchila, at the beginning, sheyuchlu lekayem et hamitzvot al yedei mesirat nefesh, al kol panim, it'll give them the power in Russia or wherever, that at first they'll be able to keep the mitzvot at least through self-sacrifice. I miss out the brackets. Va'ad she'achakach lo yitzdachu l'mesirat nefesh klal. And then afterwards they come to another stage, they don't need self-sacrifice, it'll be easy. Va'ad she'lo yiyah lahem nisyonot va'afilu lo meniyot v'ikuvim. And eventually they won't have any difficulties whatsoever. Ki yeitzu l'cherut, because they'll come out free. And they'll be able to keep Torah mitzvot from plenty, in the midst of plenty. K'mayim HaRazal, as the sages say in the Talmud, kol ha'makayim et ha'Torah me'oni, anyone who keeps the Torah from poverty, in the midst of poverty, Sofol lekayma ba'osher, will eventually keep it in the midst of wealth. You can see that at that moment the Rebbe's vision was that the Russian Jews would be allowed to come out. And there are a number of very interesting stories about this, with the Rebbe setting up an organization in Israel to deal with the Jews who were going to come out of Russia. And at that moment, Jews weren't coming out of Russia. But the Rebbe said they are going to come, and so therefore there have to be organizations to help them. So one of the organizations he set up was the Shamir organization to help Russian intellectuals find jobs in Israel. So it was set up by a person called Professor Herman Branova, who himself was a Russian a physicist. And he was helped by an English Jew called Peter Kalms. And Peter Kalms wrote a book about the series of discussions with the Rebbe and it leading to the formation of this Shamir. Was a kind of a loose club for Russian intellectuals, academics of different kinds, to be able to feel in a moderately Jewish environment. It wasn't very religious. It was just moderately a little bit of religious flavor, but not so much that they would feel threatening, but to be able to make them feel at home and that they would be able to get academic jobs or do the right kind of thing to be able to use their expertise in the Israeli context. And all this was being set up before there were large numbers of Jews coming up, and then they came. So we can see this discourse as moving in this direction. Since the Torah is eternal in every time and every place, מובן שצדקה זו היא גם במקומות שאין שם גזרות על תורה מצוות. This kind of tzedakah, this kind of effect, applies also in places where there aren't decrees concerning Torah mitzvah. Now this discourse was said originally in 1978, but it was mugah by the Rebbe, it was edited by the Rebbe, as it says in the very first footnote, in Tavshin Nun, which is 1989. Now, 1989, alright, that was still Erev Glasnost. Glasnost hadn't quite happened yet, but it was
just a year or two before.
Yeah, it was shortly before. Yeah. But the Rebbe is saying here that the same structure applies in other places as well. ויובן זה על פי מה שכתוב, מה שאמר כבוד קדושת מורי וחמי אדמו"ר. What the previous Rebbe said, בעניין מצוות פדיון שבויים. That's the concept of redeeming of captives. Now, the idea of פדיון שבויים is a very important mitzvah of the Torah, that if one hears about a Jew, that they are kept captive somewhere, one should work very hard to get them free. This may be one of the reasons why the huge numbers of slaves that the Romans sent from Israel throughout the Roman Empire, there are very, very few historical records of Jewish slaves in any country. Like, you know, there are no, apparently, there are no Latin records about there was a Jewish slave in Rome and he did this or he did that. And one theory is, there's like a double side to the theory. One theory is that the Jews wanted to keep Shabbat, which is very inconvenient if you're a slave. So, bad buy. You know, don't get a Jewish slave. And Apion, the late Greek anti-Semite playwright, writing in the 3rd century or something like that, he made fun of the Jews because of their keeping of Shabbat. So one of Apion's anti-Semitic jokes was, why are shrouds expensive? Because the Jews keep Shabbat, and because they keep Shabbat they don't work, and because they don't work they haven't got any money, so they don't have any firewood to make fire, so they chop up their beds to use the wood for firewood, and so then they have to sleep on the floors, so they get ill and they die, and that's why shrouds are expensive. old Greek anti-Semitic. Coming to Hanukkah, so you can remember.
It's very interesting you tell us that there are so few records of Jewish slaves.
Yeah.
In Josephus, in his account of the destruction, there's a depiction of some 15 or 20,000 Jews taken as slaves to Rome.
Right. Yeah, there are lots of records in that direction.
Yes.
But when they get to Rome, apparently there aren't many records of Jewish slaves being maintained. So one explanation is Shabbat, as turning these slaves, maybe Kashrut as well, turning these slaves into whoever bought them sees they're a bad buy and tries to get rid of them. But the other explanation is the mitzvah of Pidyon Shvuyim. Redemption of captives. As soon as one slave is free and he's got a job and somehow he's got some money together and he sees another slave, he buys that slave and sets him free. So it's like a snowball effect of Jews acquiring freedom on behalf of each other. So,
and that's being used now as a metaphor for Jewish for study of Torah.
Now he's going to apply this in a spiritual way. That there is the idea of Pidyon Shvuyim in spiritual terms. Redemption of captives in spiritual terms. So here with the top of page Ayin Dalet. Are you able to see that? Let me see. We have this wonderful photocopier, which photocopies on both sides, but it makes it much harder to follow. Here, the commode. The Kamosha has Shavui Begashmiut, just as the person who has been taken captive in physical terms, Hayoshev Bamasa, who's sitting in prison, Eino Yachol Latzet Misham, is not able to get out. Al Derech Zeh, in the same way, Hu Gam Beruchniut. It's also in spiritual terms. Now this is extremely interesting. Shelefamima Adam Shavui Rachmana Litzlan, that sometimes the person is captive, God forbid, God save us, Rachman Alitzan, bidei Yitzcho, in the hands, in the power of his evil desire. He gives an example of this. It's not exactly evil desire, it's like the worldly aspect of a person. Va'al derech, for example, ba'alei asakim, a businessman, Hatchudim umutchadim b'yoter b'tiedot azkehem, who are troubled and deeply involved in the worries about their business, shehem kashurim, and they are tied, and in fact shvuyim, they're captive, b'machshavot hamavalbalot, in the confusing thoughts, ve'einam yecholim latzet mehem, and they're not able to get out of those thoughts. So it's really a psychological state of a person being trapped in their anxieties, which arise perhaps from a fully understandable aspect of the material world, that the person is a businessman and he's worried about this and maybe that, and perhaps he could do this, and he's just not able to free himself from that thinking, that aggravated thinking. Sometimes he's like someone forced, like it's beyond his willpower. He all the time has these difficult thoughts coursing through his mind. As Maimonides puts it, as the Rambam puts it, in a halachic context, Yitzcho hu shetkafo. It's his evil desire which is forcing him. Now the Rebbe's used the example of a person who is caught by anxiety thoughts of his business, and as a result, for example, he's not able to pray properly, because when he starts praying, he just goes on thinking about business. So it could be worse. You know, there could be a worse thoughts which take control of a person's mind and are somehow restricting their spiritual freedom, trapping them. It could be really like the thoughts of business are thoughts about something permitted. It could be something which is thoughts of something forbidden. V'zeu inyan atzdaka. This is the charity of God. Al yedei shepizran levein amot. The fact that God scattered the Jews among the different nations. Gam nogeh lemkomot harvacha. Even in terms of the places where there is comfort, where one isn't being oppressed. Because we look at this other situation of spiritual oppression. When a certain Jew is captive in the hand of his own Yetzer Hara, Rachmana Litzlan, God protect us, as pertains to some particular inyan. You see, one can be captive on this inyan and free on that inyan. Yitziyato ma'ashivyahi, his going out of that captivity is, now this is a very interesting line, lo b'koach atzmo. In the case of this person, he's not able to do it with his own strength. Kivin she'ein chavush mati atzmo. Because someone who's tied up, this is a Talmudic saying, someone who's tied up can't get untied. If someone's tied up, so usually they need someone else to untie them. Of course, a person could be very determined and be able to do it themselves. Just like Houdini could get out of being tied up, and you could tie him up and lock him in a safe, and nonetheless he's able to get untied and get out of the safe. And there are people who, in terms of their own inner struggle, are able lishlot al atzman. There's a concept, moach shalit al halev, the mind controls the heart. And in theory, someone who is really able to activate that concept in his or her own life will be completely free, because they will never have any kind of inner oppression, because they could always say, you know what, this isn't the time to think about business. I'm going to start thinking about business 8 o'clock in the morning tomorrow. But now I have to do this, I have to study this, I have to pray, I have to whatever. And 8 o'clock in the morning, 7 o'clock he prays shachrit. 8 o'clock in the morning he starts worrying about business. So that's moach shalit al halev. But most of us don't have this rigor, and so therefore, al yedei yehudi she'eino natun b'shivya b'nogel inyan zeh. Through the effect of a Jew who is not in this captivity as regards this topic. It's interesting. See, maybe he is. Well, wait, let's just finish the thought. Vahainu, that means the gam kasheg. Okay. In other words, we'll read this next line in a moment. The person cannot get themselves out of their own trap, but another person can help them. And this is a very, very interesting expression of the power of the relationship between people. The Rebbe very much encouraged a concept called a mashpia. A mashpia is a friend. It might be a slightly older friend, or a rabbi, or a rebbetzin, or something like that. Or it might just be, you know, among students in the yeshiva, it might be just an older student, something like that. And the point is that if I discuss with my friend my problem, my friend doesn't have the same problem. So he may have difficulties in other areas, but he doesn't have my problem. He's able to look objectively at my problem. He may be able to help me get out of my problem. he might say a word, just a suggestion, and the penny drops, and that helps me lever myself out of the problem with his help. And it doesn't mean he's a perfect person. You see, the Rebbe is a Hasidic Rebbe, so he could be presenting this image in terms of a Rebbe who, you know, like the ideal concept of a Rebbe. The Rebbe is someone who could do this for anyone. I heard an interesting story last night. There was a man who had a most terrible, terrible experience, actually in the Israeli battlefield. It was the most terrible thing where there was a platoon, and the platoon, I think it was in the Sinai campaign, David, do you remember? It was in the Sinai campaign, and suddenly this platoon of Israeli soldiers are told, from base, we're very sorry to tell you that you are completely surrounded by Egyptian soldiers and we see no hope for you and we can't get any reinforcements to you. And they hear this and they're absolutely depressed, they don't know what to do. And one of them suddenly says, Jews, don't give up hope. And he gives them a whole pep talk that they shouldn't give up hope and we'll fight against them. And another man who is there decides, if I get out of this alive, I'm going to put on tefillin. I'm going to put on tefillin every day. Anyway, the battle took place and the platoon was basically successful. And they all survived, except one. The one man who'd been killed was the one who gave them the pep talk. And the man who decided he's going to put on tefillin every day, which go on the left arm, in the fighting, he lost his left arm. So he now came, I mean, he can still put on tefillin on the right arm, but it's like, so he came to the Rebbe with a question. How could this be? That the one man who gave us the pep talk, and otherwise we would have all been killed, and he gave us the pep talk, and so we were able to fight, and we succeeded. Why should he have been killed, and I, who decided I'd put on tefillin, why is it that I lost my arm? And the Rebbe said to him, God did it. And as the speaker, Rabbi Jacobson, said, you know, if someone else would have told him that, it might not have had much effect. But the fact that the Rebbe said it, somehow that put his mind at rest. You know what? God has his own cheshbon. I don't know what it is, but there it is. So, and he was able to go on. He stopped being depressed. Have I got the story right?
Yeah.
Or have I mixed up two different stories?
No, that's the same.
Okay.
He was the wonderful man in the platoon.
Yeah, yeah. So the point is that a Rebbe can tell a person something which has a tremendous effect in that person's life, and they're able to use that as a... I have a friend, the Rebbe said to him, you should always be certain about what you say. You know, like, whatever you say it with conviction. And he does, and he's transformed the lives, probably, of maybe more than 1,000 people, you know, that, in a, probably quite a lot, in an amazing way, you know, all from this statement from the Rebbe, you know, speak with conviction. But even if it's not a Rebbe, as he goes on to say here, it's an imperfect person. The only thing is, he's imperfect in a different dimension. So, Vahainu, we're at this word Vahainu, which is 3, 6, 7, 8 words, 8 lines down. Vahainu, that means the gam kashe gam apode osto mehashivya. Even when the one who redeems him from the captivity, who shavui bidei yitzcho, he is captive in his own yetzer hara in something else. Va'ad shehu kumo anus. He himself is like someone who is trapped, Yitzru Hushkafor, in his evil desire, but Nugele Mitzvah Achelet, as regards a different mitzvah. So the one who doesn't put on tefillin can tell the one who doesn't give tzedakah, you know what, you should give tzedakah. And at another occasion, he can say to him, you know what, you should put on tefillin. You know, and so they can help each other up the rungs of the ladder. Mikol makon, kibun shebenegeh lechama vechama mitzvot, eina shavui bidei mitzvot, since for many mitzvot he is not captive, ki yitnagdut ha-yitzarai eitzel kol echad, because the attack, the campaign of the evil desire for each individual, hu be'ikah b'inyin acher, is generally something different. Each person's different. So each one has their own package of problems, spiritual problems, and spiritual strengths. And so you meet another person, you've got a spiritual strength where they've got a problem, so you can help them. Even though, on the other hand, every one of us can say, well, I've also got spiritual problems, but that doesn't matter in relation to the strength that we have helping another person. Like the Rebbe said, if you know Aleph and Bet, it's true, you don't know Gimel, Dalet, Hey, but you know Aleph and Bet. So you can teach someone who doesn't know Aleph. So you can teach that, so you can give the person something positive. So there is, it's a very, very fascinating concept here, which he expands in this paragraph. The whole idea about each person is an individual matrix, as it were, of different problems and strengths, and each one is very individual in this way, and therefore we're always able to help another person or be helped by another person, because we are able, we've got a strength where they haven't, or they have a strength where we haven't. If we turn over the page, Gimel. Now, there's an interesting question which was raised in the original discourse said in 1928 by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak. V'lefi perus zeh b'tzidgat pilzonon, according to this commentary which the Talmud gives by Rabbi Oshia, that it's daka, it is right here, you got it? Here, page Ayin Hei, at the top. That this, sorry, it's so confusing. Let's see. Oh, the Ayin Hei is hidden by the by the staple.
Oh, okay.
So just Gimel. Gimel is easy. Sorry. Yeah, the Ayin Hei is hidden by the staple. Thank you. The fi perus zeh b'tzidkat pirzono, this comment in the Talmud, staka, God did something righteous for the Jewish people that he scattered them. Hava le'lomar tzidkat pizrono.
What's the difference, pirzon and pirzon?
Yeah, now that's the interesting thing. You see, they're really two different words. One word is lefazer, to scatter, and the other is prazot, to break through, like prazot teshev Yerushalayim. Jerusalem will be so full of people in the time of Mashiach that it will be arim haprazot. There's a concept of arei choma, cities with a wall, and cities without a wall. So a city without a wall is called Arim Prazot. Prazot Teshev Yerushalayim, it will be filled with people spreading out. They won't be able to have a wall because there'll be always another settlement, another shikun, another this, another that. It'll be expanding more and more.
Like
as it is. What?
Like Paris.
Yeah, or like Jerusalem.
Paris.
Or like Paris. Okay. So that word, in other words, the idea of scattering the Jewish people. See, the Talmud has the power, if you like, to look at a verse and turn the word around and translate it as if it's something else. But it's as if this concept of the unity of the Jewish people and each of us having an effect on the other, so that we're able to help each other spiritually, as we just read, and in different dimensions, whether it's that they are not able to keep the mitzvot because the law is against them keeping mitzvot, or because their own inner dynamic prevents them keeping mitzvot. But nonetheless, each of us is able to help each other personally. That relates to the idea of breaking through the walls of Chazot Teshev Yerushalayim, of Jerusalem being burst through by the people living there more and more and more. V'hainu shatztaka sha'asa kadosh baruch hu b'Yisrael b'zeh. The righteousness, the kindness that God did for the Jewish people by scattering them, al yedei shepizran levein ha'umot, by scattering them among the nations, who bichdei is in order, sha'al yedei zeh, that eventually, through this, yagiyu lemadrega na'alit yoter, they'll come to a higher level, mikamo sha'ayu lifnei ha'yirida depizran, before they came to that descent of the problem, va'ad lebchinat p'chazot teshev Yerushalayim. So in other words, it moves from the connection of the Jewish people together, one moves to the dimension of the bursting forth from Yerushalayim, broader and broader and broader. Okay, now this is one aspect of the discourse, which is a very beautiful concept, which is about the unity of the Jewish people, the interaction of the Jewish people, and the way that ultimately this has a messianic goal, the Pchazot Teshev Yerushalayim. It then moves into a further concept, which is the idea of the Jerusalem inside each person. The word Yerushalayim means Yerushalem, Yirah, or fear of God. And there is a concept of Yerushalayim Shel Ma'ala and Yerushalayim Shel Mata, the upper Jerusalem and the lower Jerusalem. The lower Jerusalem is the lower level of Yirat Hashem, of fear or awe of God, which is in the heart of each person, or potentially, or it's hidden in the heart of each person. And the Yerushalayim Shel Ma'ala is the higher level of the Jerusalem, which relates to each person. And the higher level is a deeper level of awe of God, Yirat HaRomamut, the awe of the exaltation of the divine. So part of the structure of a person being a decent human being is the Yirah, the first level, the lower level of Yirah. That because of the lower level of Yirah, they're not of awe, of fear, they're not going to do negative things. They are afraid, even if they are momentarily or at some point tempted or maybe even challenged. It could be that a person is really challenged by some kind of temptation and it works round and round and round in their mind. Nonetheless, there is a basic structure inside them which stops them giving in to that challenging force. That's the inner Yerushalayim. And then we come to the higher Yerushalayim, which is not of an awe, a fear, which protects one from breaking some rule, which could lead, God forbid, to negative consequences. But it's an entirely positive concept that the awe that the person has of the infinite oneness of the divine is something which is tremendously inspiring and enables and carries them through in the most beautiful way in prayer, in Torah study, in interactions with other people, in all aspects of life. It's a tremendously powerful spiritual concept. The direction of this discourse is that the Pchazot Teshev Yerushalayim is that these inner dimensions of fear, the lower level, or the higher level, spread through the entire person, into every aspect of our being, so that we are completely suffused with this spiritual energy which comes from the inner Jerusalem, and which it says, Pchazot Teshev Yerushalayim, Jerusalem will be unwalled, it will spread out, And it also says Atida Yerushalayim litpashet al kol eretz Yisrael. Jerusalem will spread over the whole of the land of Israel. So in other words, within the person, the inner Jerusalem spreads over everything. And that is the goal, that the person comes. It's a hypnotically beautiful discourse, the ways that it goes on, and the concept that the whole Jewish people are united together. Let's look at Zion. Ulochora yesh lohosif in Zion, section Zion. Right, we are trying to finish. Kizeh she'esek, fourth line down in Zion. Kizeh she'esek ha-Torah mitzvot shel echad. The fact that the study of Torah mitzvot of one, noten koach ve'oz l'sheni, gives power to the second, who lefi she'kol Yisrael hem mitzilt echad, is because the whole Jewish people are one existence. Bifrat mitzad nekudat ha'yirat shamayim va'abitul shbehem, especially because of the fear of heaven and the selflessness, which is the Yerushalayim shehi nekuda ha'ma'achedet et kol Yisrael, which is the point which unifies the whole Jewish people. V'lechein, and therefore, b'chdei she'esed the Torah mitzvot shel echad, in order that one person's Torah yiten koch voz lacher, will help another person, who kosh esek haTorah mitzvot shelo, is that this first person's Torah, he benekudad yirat meshamayim, is with the that point of heavenly, of fear of heaven, pchazot teishem Yerushalayim. Shayirat shemayim shelo, his fear of heaven, his personal Jerusalem, he beofen de ufaratzta, is in such a way of bursting forth, yama vekedma vatzafona vanegba, west and east, north and south, shemitpashetet v'choderet v'chol kochot ha-nefesh, it spreads through all the powers of his soul, ad b'machshava dibur u'maaseh shelo, even reaching his thought, speech and action. So that is the course of this discourse, the idea of ultimate redemption, which leads to the concept of ultimate redemption. But what's very interesting is that, having explained the way that people are able to interact and help each other, the Rebbe does his job, as it were, by activating the Yerushalayim in each person, so that we are then able to help ourselves. So he is taking the part of being the one giving the advice, how you're able to cope with this particular problem, spiritual problem, or that particular spiritual problem, because the Jerusalem inside you is strong and is spreading through the whole of you, and by focusing on that quality within us, this discourse enables us to express that strength, which is the inner Yirat Hashem becoming dominant within our being. And as each one of us is able to connect with this depth of spirituality flowing through every aspect of our lives, in that way too we interact with everyone else, and everyone else is able to do that as well, and that brings the whole of existence to a higher state of being. So that is, and that is really the nekuda of what the revelation of Hasidism is all about, and the triumphant song of Devorah, and also Rabbi Oshia. It's Rabbi Oshia in the Talmud says, he gives the comment on the song of Devorah, and Rabbi Oshia, it's like Yoshua, it's like salvation. It's like, so Rabbi Oshia is teaching how we can reach, how we can get out of these difficulties and reach Geula.
Tali, who was Rabbi Oshia?
I must tell you that I don't know any more details about him. There's a wonderful encyclopedia of Talmudic scholars in Hebrew. There may be a similar thing in English, where one can look up his name and then it'll tell you all the different places in the Talmud where he's mentioned and what he's famous for, and a story about him, when he lived and which generation. By alternative, you can maybe Google him and you might find all kinds of interesting
the Far Ilan University site.
Okay.
Tali, this section bit in which it's being mapped out that somebody's that one person's limitations are offset by another's, and that people help each other. This is a very remarkably pertinent section for those of us who are working therapeutically.
Absolutely. I thought that when I was reading this, when I was preparing this, I immediately thought of that that concept. Yes, absolutely.
Where would I find a translation of the section bet that would be serviceable, that I could make use of?
Unless we have anyone willing to donate. I haven't seen a translation of it. A very, very small number of the Rebbe's discourses have actually been translated in print. And I don't think this is one of them.
So it's so centrally related to the work I do.
I appreciate that.
Well, you can put it in Google, and Google will translate it. Yes. Or Babylon.
Ask a friend.
Sorry?
Ask one of you people.
It's not easy to translate this.
Yeah.
And Google will produce a nonsense.
Well, a start. Hmm.
Much worse than what you would.
Thank you. I don't compare.